Tortoise.
Hello, I'm Giles Patel. I'm Tortoise's deputy editor. It's the week beginning Monday, the 25th of March. From Tortoise, welcome to the news meeting.
Tonight there have been incredibly disturbing scenes coming out of Moscow, where gunmen entered a concert hall and opened fire on the crowd there.
Catherine, the Princess of Wales, made a shocking announcement.
The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present.
The impact of the princess's diagnosis has been felt far and wide.
Donald Trump's lawyers say he's been unable to obtain a bond for the $454 million he owes as part of a civil fraud judgment against him.
Now to the Israel-Hamas war. Prime Minister Netanyahu vowing to press ahead with plans to invade Rafah despite a personal appeal from Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
To help me work out what should lead the news, I'm joined today by Tortoise's political editor Kat Neelan.
Hello.
And reporter Stephen Armstrong.
Hello.
And by Hashim Mohammed, who is a broadcaster and barrister and a contributing editor here at Tortoise. Hello.
Good morning.
We're going to start with long story short. So, phrased in a sentence or a few words, what story do you want to talk about? Kat, you go first.
Mine is Hidden Dragon.
Hidden Dragon?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a bit of crouching there too,
perhaps. Yep.
Yeah, okay. Stephen.
Who is attacking and who are the victims and why?
Oh my
and that's
God.
Russia.
There was three mysteries and then you solved them all in one.
Sorry.
You could have left us hanging. Hashi.
Unlock the triple lock.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much. Kat, let's start with you. Full disclosure, we're recording this on Monday morning, but your story is going to play out in the House of Commons later today.
Sure. Well, so just to rewind a bit, over the weekend, there were a couple of quite jaw-dropping stories, I think, that broke. First was the Sunday Times, which revealed that China has attempted to hack a string of parliamentarians. That was followed by a story in The Sun about how the Electoral Commission was also hacked and that the details of around 40 million Brits have been compromised as a result. And we are sort of rolling forward to today. There are two sort of interesting things happening. Firstly, the parliamentarians who were hacked, which include Ian Duncan Smith, the former Conservative leader and quite a sort of high profile China hawk, and Tim Loughton, who was also a minister and is another sort of quite renowned China hawk, are among the parliamentarians who it is alleged have been hacked by China, and they are receiving a briefing today from Parliament's Director of Security, Alison Giles. Then after that, they are going to be giving a press conference. And then this afternoon, we are hearing from, or sort of possibly early evening, depending on whether there are sort of questions, I suspect, about what happened in Russia first. So perhaps early evening, we will be hearing from Oliver Dowden, the Deputy Prime Minister, who will update the Commons about these Chinese attempts to hack British MPs and peers. It's expected that he may announce some sanctions, which is interesting because not so long ago, there was a sort of step away from that kind of slightly more full-throated kind of response to China. Mm-hmm. And particularly, there has been a lot of pressure from people like Ian Duncan Smith on the government to do more in regards to particularly the abuses in Xinjiang, mm-hmm. towards the Uyghur people, but also in Hong Kong, where we kind of see this kind of ongoing rumbling and erosion of human rights since the handover. It's particularly kind of ratcheted up over the last couple of years. Now, this evening, there will be an address to the 1922 Committee, which is the group of backbench Conservative MPs, from Lord Cameron. Mm-hmm. Last week, they heard from Rishi Sunak. Tonight, they will be hearing from the Foreign Secretary, who, when he was Prime Minister, famously was the sort of architect of the golden age of relations between Britain and China. And of course, more recently, in fact, sort of around the time that he was announced as Foreign Secretary, it emerged that he was working on behalf of the Sri Lankan component of the Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's big infrastructure project.
That's in the sort of interim between Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary.
It was when he was a private citizen.
Out there looking
yes.
for bit
but
of money.
He was sort of working on behalf of that project right. to try and encourage further investment, I think. Yeah. But obviously now that he's Foreign Secretary, yeah. that's sort of put to one side. But this kind of whole backdrop is very interesting because obviously Conservatives are always divided about everything. But Rishi Sunak has taken a less sort of robust response towards China, I think, than, you know, if you kind of compare his attitude to that was being put forward by Liz Truss yep. during the leadership contest. She was much more on the hawks side, Rishi Sunak much less. And that has kind of continued during his time in office. So last year, there was the Intelligence and Security Committee report into China, really criticising the lack of joined up thinking within government and the failure to address this growing threat that China presents, both in terms of the sort of intelligence side, but also in terms of commercial aspects.
And the commercial is mainly IP theft, that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can I just interrupt to ask, when did the hack happen and what do we know about the nature of the hack? In other words, if I'm IDS, Ian Duncan Smith, who was hacked, are we talking my emails or what?
In terms of the date, the Electoral Commission hack was in August 2021, but it wasn't identified until October 2022.
Apparently, today is the day that this story has come out, and today is the day that they're giving this briefing. But today also happens to be simultaneously a bill is going through Parliament called the Data Protection and Digital Information Bill, which is all about also gathering people's personal data by our government.
Yeah.
And it's going to committee stage today, 25th of March, where further amendments are due to be discussed. So am I right to be cynical about a bill that's going to allow the government to do more snooping on us being discussed on the very day that we're being told the Chinese are snooping on all of us?
Cock up or conspiracy? Is Hashi being overly suspicious here?
It's a good question. I mean, I think it's sufficiently uncomfortable for both the Foreign Secretary and the Prime Minister to make me think that they wouldn't necessarily want this out there in general. Because the other big thing that's happening today is this new electric vehicle factory that's being unveiled sort of as part of the, you know, proof that we can attract foreign investment and particularly in the sort of, you know, levelling up agenda. And so, I mean, my sense is that it is incredibly uncomfortable for a government that is still going around cap in hand to to Chinese companies, which, as we all know, act as backdoors for Chinese state to kind of build huge kind of critical infrastructure type projects at a time when they're saying that the government, the Chinese government, has been trying to hack senior members of the UK Parliament. I think that there is this kind of sense that we are
tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We are not in a position to sort of turn down the money from China for various projects. And that makes us, that puts us in a very difficult position. It means that we can't be as robust as perhaps people would like us to be. And I think that may explain why there has been this kind of reluctance. I mean, you have to kind of only look, I think it was last autumn when James Cleverly was basically saying that the UK is open for business. And Rishi Sunak was getting into a lot of criticism from members of his party and further afield for effectively not sort of taking the Intelligence and Security Committee report more seriously. You know, when that came out, one of the responses was, well, yes, but it's based on old intelligence and you know, things have changed since then. And I was at the press conference when the report was being launched, and that initial response was put to the various committee members, and they were visibly outraged and argued that although that was the kind of period when the report was kind of principally looking at, they had taken intelligence subsequently. So it was not a sort of closed door from, I think it was 2020, was the theoretical end of the kind of field work. But they had been taking on board other intelligence.
Steve, what do you make of this? Is it a told you so moment for those who didn't take the report that Kat's talking about seriously enough, and for those who remember Huawei?
Yes, I think, I mean, firstly, I'd say I think that that Hashi's cynicism is valid, but I tend to think that the way the government currently is briefing on online safety is children. They will always say children. It's about threats against paedophiles, about threats against bullying, and that's their sort of backdoor briefing on why they need to be on every single phone. I don't think you should dismiss the idea that this is connected, but I do think at the moment they're briefing on kids more than the Chinese. So this may be a new front, but it doesn't feel like it feels much more like it is the EV plant. I mean, China makes all of the EVs essentially that are made in the UK. They make the Nissan Sunderland EVs. They're going to make the Tata EVs batteries.
Oh, they make the batteries
yes.
for them.
All so right. they make so and if, when we tried to launch our own battery company, British Volt, it collapsed. We can't do it. So we are. I mean, effectively, we are becoming a Belt and Road country. You know, we're in a situation where that is. We and you mentioned Remainer, so I think I'm entitled to say, and I apologise for this, but it is kind of a Brexit story. Essentially, what we have is
Don't apologise.
We have failed to do the deal with the United States. That was the centrepiece of how we were going to go forward. Do the deal with the US. It hasn't happened. We get about, I think it's about $100 billion in trade with China. We haven't got a proper trade deal with them. We're trying to expand the joint committee, the trading committee, which has been dormant since 2018. It's kind of a debt. We kind of need the money.
Okay, let's move on. Steve, tell us about your story.
So I wanted to talk about the terrorist attack in the Moscow rock concert. I think for a number of reasons. I think that the way that the UK, certainly, the American media to a lesser extent, have covered this is to move very swiftly to look at what Putin's response is in regards to the Ukraine. And that is a legitimate question, of course. My partner is Russian-born, and she spent the weekend receiving the coverage from particularly the UK in particular broadcast. And she was saying there's no space in here for the human tragedy. So if you compare the response to Bataclan or to Manchester, admittedly, those are friendly countries or our country. But there's no speculation then about would Holland bomb Syria, as it turns out he did. But that wasn't where we went. We went to the people. And there are, you know, terrible stories from that rock concert where, you know, there was when the roof fell in, there was one single toilet where there was something like 20 odd people and the mothers were sheltering the children with their bodies. It's a heartbreaking story. But we go straight to the Putin strategic vision. We also haven't spent much time looking at Islamic State and the Islamic State in Khorasan province. I mean, I think it's significant that the last two major Islamic State attacks have been in Iran and Russia. This idea that this is a terrorist organization which has a wide-ranging agenda and will tackle anyone who's interfering in certain parts of the Middle East. And what that does for Putin is he is trying to maintain his control over his people. And again, as my partner was saying, all he needs to do is to sow a tiny bit of doubt. It's the classic KGB tactic. What you do is you suggest there may be a window in Ukraine. You don't even have to prove it. She was watching his speech in Russian and he doesn't really prove anything. Just sows it out there. Her mother is of that generation. She says to her mother, "You're going to the bank today?" And she says, "I might." Because it's just this constant destabilize the person so they don't quite know what's going on. But the point she was making was that there's 13% of the Russian people who voted against Putin. They are going to have a terrible decade now, those individuals. They're going to have a terrible, terrible time. And they're going to see the West not paying them attention. We have a moment where we're turning away from the Russian people and assuming that they are entirely 100% complicit in Putin's evil.
Wait. Explain that last point. 13% of Russians who voted against Putin, why necessarily now
because they know who they are. They know who they are. So if you voted against Putin, the state knows who voted against Putin. So your life is going to be miserable for 10 years.
How do they know that?
Because you register your vote. The poll card isn't anonymous.
They're not anonymous.
Their numbers.
I thought it was sort of purported to be a secret ballot, but the secrecy was often eroded.
I mean, it's purported to be a secret ballot, but isn't it? It isn't a secret. I mean, why would he have a secret ballot when he doesn't have to? So it isn't a secret. So if you vote against you, that's why Navalny wasn't saying don't vote or wasn't saying vote against Putin. He was just saying vote at a particular time because he knew the risks that people faced if they were to vote against Putin or to be seen to known to be voting against Putin. So we can assume that 13% represents that is a tiny fraction of the number of people who are discontented. But when they turn to see how we respond to their tragedy, their human tragedy, we don't care. We assume they are. It feels like, certainly to my partner, that we assume that the Russians are complicit in the evil, and that isn't necessarily the case. So,
but just on, I take that point that there was no Bataclan space, if you like. But given how quickly Putin himself tried to turn it to strategic advantage, it is legitimate, isn't it, for news organisations to follow that part of the story as the bit that goes straight to the jugular.
It is legitimate, I think, but that doesn't mean you remove completely that other story. If you look at the headlines, I mean, the headlines are starting to emerge today, partly because ISIS have released the video from within the concert hall. But, I mean, this was a suburban concert hall, an old prog rock band from the 1970s. These were families there. Mm-hmm. Whatever the despotic nature of their regime, they're entitled to try and have a good time. All the headlines on Saturday and Sunday were exposes flaws in Putin's regime. It's all about the Putin game. Mm-hmm. And the people. And I think it's significant that she would notice that right. was missing.
And how does that affect popular support for Putin? Does it ultimately benefit him? And I'm sorry, I'm falling into the same trap. But if what you say is true, that to the extent the Russian narod, the people, are concerned about how this has been perceived abroad, they resent the fact that we haven't paid attention to the human story. Will that bolster their support for the regime? Is this a solidarity moment?
I think, I'm now quoting one person. So this is a survey of one Russian. Her position was that this, particularly the presence of ISIS, is going to be undermining to Putin's position. Mm-hmm. But the question is, how can he shut that story down? Mm-hmm. So his role now is to try to shut down and close out the ISIS message. And for a lot of moderately educated Russians, that's not that hard for him to do. It's kind of hard. They can go to places and get other information, but you tend to have to be of a particular group of people to receive that global information.
Do we know why ISIS has supposedly done this? What was the purpose behind this?
Well, I mean, Russia, of course, is in Syria fighting Daesh. And so that's really their position, is to take on anyone who is involved in that area. Plus, a lot of those ISIS fighters are working against the Taliban in Afghanistan. So Afghanistan is under Russia's purview.
But have we heard that, though? Have we heard that from the people who supposedly have conducted this?
The ISIS reference was Syria, rather than Afghanistan. Right. I mean, the people who've been captured by the Russians are Tajiks. So which he
and they are ISIS-K, ISIS Khorasan, rather than ISIS.
But it's a franchise operation, isn't it? It is a terrorist organization as a franchise.
But the Syria reference that you refer to was from where? ISIS Global Headquarters or ISIS-K?
The people who released the video. So
ISIS Global HQ placed in where?
So it's where they're explaining why they committed that particular attack. So and in each particular unit of ISIS has its own particular concerns. It's reached the point now, it's a little bit like the Algerian independence war, where there were groups of people who declared the entire world apostate, apart from the 11 of them. And so this is kind of, ISIS is fighting everybody right now and releasing statements saying who, when they do.
Kat, what do you make of this story?
So I kind of applaud Stephen's attempt to try and bring some humanity back into it. But I think that there are human tragedies happening all around the world all the time that we glancingly note, you know, Gaza, Sudan, that the human tragedy story is a component of it. But I think it is understandable that people have gone immediately to the more consequential, what does this mean for Ukraine? What does this mean for Putin? What does this mean for ISIS? I actually thought you were going to go for the ISIS angle, because I think that has been a...
You're doing the cheeky double-hander.
I think the ISIS component has been slightly underplayed in the coverage that I've seen. And I think it is interesting because it does remind you that they are still very active, and it does make you think, why Russia instead of another country? And, you know, one of the things that I did hear over the weekend was the shift in their tactics into going into a venue and shooting people rather than, you know, kind of the suicide bomber type approaches or you know, kind of kidnappings and so on.
I think that actually the reason I linked the two stories is also because part of the reason I think, as I read, that it was easier for ISIS to operate in Russia is that the security service internal surveillance has been directed more towards LGBTQ plus people, towards Navalny, and there is the story that that America warned Putin this was going to happen, and he rejected it as being a piece of Western provocation, because he so there was the idea that the Russian security service weren't taking this seriously.
Okay, we're going to move on. We're going to take a quick break, in fact, and then we'll hear what Hashi thinks should lead the news.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Senior business leaders in the UK are keen to harness AI, but there's a complex regulatory maze emerging globally. The OECD, a group of the world's richest countries, which includes the UK, has adopted a new set of principles to ensure that AI operates in a way that's safe, fair, and trustworthy. The principles are wide-ranging, but in essence call for AI systems to be designed in a way that respects the rule of law and human rights, and says there should be transparency around their use. By embracing the core principles of responsible innovation, UK business leaders can better explore sector-specific opportunities and emerging trends without compromising on citizens' trust. Find out more at ey.ai.
Hello, I'm Jeevan Vasagar. I'm climate editor at Tortoise and host of a new podcast called Counter Crisis from the Centre for Disaster Protection, a UK government-funded international organisation which works to change how the world plans and pays for disasters. If you follow the news, you'll know that more people than ever are in need of humanitarian assistance. War and climate change are affecting millions, but the solutions haven't really kept pace. Finance is key. We saw during the pandemic that the countries that found it easiest to borrow money were the most able to respond, and not the countries that were the most affected. Across three episodes, covering disasters, the losses caused by climate change, and our response to disease outbreaks, I'm going to try and make sense of this. Why are the current ways we respond to crises inadequate? And how can we do better? I'll be speaking to experts to rethink the recovery from crisis and find out why prearranged finance can help get aid where it's needed. You can listen now. Search for Counter Crisis wherever you get your podcasts. Follow the feed to make sure you don't miss an episode.
Hashi.
Yes. So reminding everyone that we are in a competition here as opposed to a conversation.
Kat never needs reminding.
I woke up this morning thinking I need to beat Kat again.
It's not hard.
Here I am. My story is about the triple lock pension program, whatever you want to call it. Yesterday, the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, was on television talking about how he will protect the triple lock. For those who may not be familiar with it, this is the idea that most of our pension programs for the people who are of a certain age will be protected from inflation. It will rise
with a particular percentage every year, and he will ensure that the pension that they receive isn't undermined by effectively the economy and the weather of how things work. Now, I think on an election year, to promise that the triple lock will remain is the most scandalous issue of our time. Now, I don't want to pit the young against the old,
but
the, you know, people like me and people like Charles, sorry.
maybe I will win.
It's my attempt at offer some humour. And I just think that Labour is also apparently seeking to maintain the same thing. On an election year, I think that this is a nakedly political calculation of thinking that there's a people of a certain age who will come out and vote for us as Tories, and therefore we cannot piss them off. And I think that's terrible, it's unfair, it's unsustainable, and there are so many young people today who are unable to vote in this election who are going to be left behind. The state pension is to rise by 8.5% in April. And that will mean that it will benefit the luckiest generation of modern times. People who were able to buy their houses for a relatively cheap price. People who were able to get their pensions sort of pegged in a way that was always going to be beneficial. People who were able to stay in good jobs for longer, that paid well, that allowed them to retire potentially even earlier. People who were able to really do well are now being cushioned even more into their retirement. Now, compare that to an average young person today. You're coming out of university with a significant amount of debt. You're going to work later, retire later, have poor salaries, and having to change your job on a number of occasions. And if you're trying to live in the major cities of this country, well, good luck to you, because you'll need a miracle in addition to a bank that's going to give you any help. There is no hope for many of these young people, no house. And then what do they get? They get the caricaturing, the belittling. They're spending all their money on Netflix and avocados. This isn't an election year. What is the hope for these young people? There is none. And as for those of the generation who had the best that could possibly be, what do they get? Even more money, even more protection, and even better benefits. And I think that's scandalous, and that's why I think I should win.
Thank you very much for that, Hashi. Jeremy Hunt also said yesterday that it was those on average and lower incomes who stood to benefit most from, for example, his national insurance
cut. Which for him was £100,000.
Exactly. I saw that.
He had to address that and said that he was chatting with a constituent from his own prosperous constituency
in Surrey,
and he trotted out the figures carefully rehearsed for average and lower incomes.
Yeah, and I just
it is also fashionable, isn't it, to note how comfortable the current generation of retirees is, but there are also a lot of much less well-off retirees who need the triple lock.
Absolutely. No. There are plenty of people who do need it. That's why it's got to be much better targeted.
Okay.
That's the issue. For me, it's got to be much better targeted rather than this just sort of, you've reached a certain age, you get your free bus pass, you get your a free license fee winter paid for fuel. You know, you get the winter fuel allowance. And I genuinely mean this, it's not an argument that just seeks to suggest that the young have been left behind. Let's push more older people into poverty. That's not what this is about. Any civilized society has to look after its older generations, particularly those who worked so long and so hard and deserve retirement in dignity.
With your wonk hat on, how do you tailor the application of the triple lock? Can you means test a triple lock?
Well, first of all, you get rid of it because it's a blanket process that seeks to protect on a blanket level. Then you figure out how many of those percentages that we're talking about are not going to be living in prosperous or who are actually going to be needing your help, and target it. Now, I'm not sitting in Parliament or in the Treasury, but there must be a way of targeting this. There must be
AI.
A way.
I mean,
is this just a trap for Labour?
So just on that point, the argument has always been that means testing is so convoluted that it would cost more than it would benefit. But actually, we keep hearing about how brilliant AI is and, you know, all of these kind of practical uses. I don't understand why they can't just say, yeah, we're going to use AI to figure out this seemingly quite simple issue. And I completely agree with Hashi, because I do think it is a travesty. You know, in this sort of the last sort of 18 months, 2 years, where you've had public sector workers out on strike trying to get a sort of inflation linked pay rise and being told no, because you're feckless and you'll, you know, kind of lead us into a sort of spiral of inflation doom. But, you know, kind of the sort of wealthy retirees, not all, but the wealthy retirees who have a sort of additional 8.5% of the on their disposable income is somehow not going to be inflationary. It feels to me completely hypocritical, and it is just a kind of pure politicking. But that said, I don't think it is necessarily particular to the election year. It's always the case with the Conservatives.
Can I just ask, any surprise at all to you that Labour immediately says, we're sticking with the triple lock too?
No, because that's what they've been doing for the last 18 months.
Are they doing it because they have to
They can't go into an election being the party that wants to make your granny poor.
But is it one of those things which after the election, which we presume they win, they will have another think about?
They might do in the second term. Okay. I shouldn't think they do it in the first term.
I'm in a comfortable situation of both agreeing with everybody at the table and also disagreeing with them as well.
Let's hear the disagreements.
The fastest rate of poverty growth in the UK is in pensioners. And the group of people with the highest rate of poverty, 25% of those people living in relative poverty, are aged 60 to 64. What we're doing is we're setting the two generations against each other. And the point is, we should all be lifting up. That's the thing. I mean, the thing about the welfare state is that it ought not to be means tested, because then there's no shame in taking your benefits. We ought to be able to lift us all rather than say, no, you deserve better than you. And that's where we're going.
I hear that. But the problem I have with that analysis of saying we've got to lift all of ourselves up together is it sort of ignores the simple point that there has to be trade-offs. There have to be balances and trade-offs. For some people to do well, other people may potentially have to do less well. Not bad, less well. And at the moment, the conversation is triple lock, triple lock, triple lock. Ask them what they've got for an 18-year-old going either to university or an apprenticeship. They haven't got a clue. Mm.
Okay. So those are the stories. Russia after the attack on the Crocus Concert Hall, triple lock forever, and China hacks the UK's Electoral Commission. Now you have to, each of you, tell me which one you think should lead the news and then not allowed to choose your own. Kat.
As you can tell, I'm very exercised about the triple lock, and I do strongly agree with Hashi's diagnosis, but I don't think it's the news story for the day. I think it is Stephen's story, but I suspect that you will get short shrift with the bleeding hearts angle. I think you probably, I would say, go for the Islamic State reiterated, redefined, and then you've got me.
Stephen?
Well, I actually, even though I opposed virulently large parts of Hashi's argument, I do think that the broader picture it paints, and actually in a way it does link to what we were saying earlier about how vulnerable the UK is. It illustrates in a very neat way just how vulnerable the country is at the moment, that we don't have the money to do these things. So I think it is probably in the long term for all of us the most important story.
Hashi?
I'm going to go with Kat's story, but from a different angle, which is that, yes, the Chinese will try and use espionage to try and get as much of our intellectual and other properties as much as they can. But I would add the angle of the bill that's currently going through Parliament and actually say, hang on, this has been a story for a while. Why is it been getting a particular prominence around the time that this bill is going through Parliament? Can we examine that and unpack that? Not to undermine the very real threat that comes from China, but also to better understand what the government's intending for the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks all of you. Here's what I think. Hashi definitely wins for power and concision of presentation.
Not substance.
My problem with the story, and Kat will recognise this, and I'm sure that there's a problem with my analysis, this is a policy of a party which is about to lose very, very heavily in the next election. We don't know how heavily, but heavily. And I find it hard to take any of their policy positions extremely seriously right now. I do recognise it's a serious question, the extent to which Labour grasps the nettle on this, as so many other policy questions after the election, their general position seems to be, please, please don't ask us for details because you'll just record what we say and use it against us. But it's not going to lead the news, and nor is the Chinese electoral hack. The single most fascinating aspect of this story to me is the gradual shift from celebrating, not just on Cameron's part, but everybody, especially those who profited from it, the collaboration between our Western economy and their Eastern economy, which was the zeitgeist, you know, 10, perhaps even just 5 years ago, as you say, to demonizing it now, and a sense that we will inevitably follow in the direction the US is leading for a clean break, if necessary, whatever the macroeconomic cost. Kat is right in a sense. I'm going, Steve, with your story, the aftermath of the ISIS-K attack on the Russian concert hall, not because Western media outlets have neglected the human component of the story, though I accept that they have, and there's a whole interesting set of questions as to why, but because it raises the question, how firm is Putin's control really? And one piece of context that I'd throw into the pot there is that while the gunman managed to walk in and kill 133 plus people,
nearly 40 now, with 200 still missing dead,
you've also got unrelated but still destabilizing pro-Ukrainian Russian militia groups launching some fairly successful attacks on villages and towns in the extreme west of Russia. So while Putin projects an image of absolute authority, the reality on the ground increasingly is rather different.
So Hashi, I would say the next time you come in, Giles does speak Russian. So that is a tip for next time you bring a story in.
Very, very poorly. But the stands were once my beat. And I'm fascinated as we learn more, as I hope we will, about why ISIS-K was recruiting in Tajikistan. But that is the running order. Russia wins in a strange sense.
Boo.
See, that Western media anti-Russian sentiment. That's what's going on.
That's it for this episode of The News Meeting. If you think there's a story we missed, and heaven knows we didn't talk about Kate, Princess of Wales, or Trump and his bond, which he must meet for nearly $500 million today, or very soon, then you can email us on newsmeeting@tortoisemedia.com. And that's exactly what Kerry did after hearing Friday's episode. He said, "Hi, Tortoise. There's one extra layer to the smoking ban. Rishi Sunak's concern for British lungs flies in the face of another of his signature policy moves, delaying the transition to EVs, as well as his very vocal opposition to the ULEZ expansion. That is ultra-low emission zone in London. Air quality, Kerry says, is responsible for 47,000 premature deaths in the UK each year. That's 60% of the reported deaths from smoking." Thank you, Kerry. Thank you, Kat and Stephen. See you soon. And thank you, Hashi, very much for joining us. We'll be back with another episode on Friday when the author and podcaster Elizabeth Day will be our special guest. Until then, have a good week.
Tortoise. Hello, I'm Jeevan Vasiga. I'm climate editor at Tortoise and host of a new podcast called Counter Crisis from the Centre for Disaster Protection, a UK government-funded international organisation which works to change how the world plans and pays for disasters. If you follow the news, you'll know that more people than ever are in need of humanitarian assistance. War and climate change are affecting millions, but the solutions haven't really kept pace. Finance is key. We saw during the pandemic that the countries that found it easiest to borrow money were the most able to respond, and not the countries that were the most affected. Across three episodes covering disasters, the losses caused by climate change, and our response to disease outbreaks, I'm going to try and make sense of this. Why are the current ways we respond to crises inadequate? And how can we do better? I'll be speaking to experts to rethink the recovery from crisis and find out why prearranged finance can help get aid where it's needed. You can listen now. Search for Counter Crisis wherever you get your podcasts. Follow the feed to make sure you don't miss an episode.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Senior business leaders in the UK are keen to harness AI, but there's a complex regulatory maze emerging globally. The OECD, a group of the world's richest countries, which includes the UK, has adopted a new set of principles to ensure that AI operates in a way that's safe, fair, and trustworthy. The principles are wide-ranging, but in essence, call for AI systems to be designed in a way that respects the rule of law and human rights, and says there should be transparency around their use. By embracing the core principles of responsible innovation, UK business leaders can better explore sector-specific opportunities and emerging trends without compromising on citizens' trust. Find out more at ey.ai.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Sometimes the transition to fall and winter feels like experiencing every season on the same day. The shoes in the Allbirds Mizzle collection were made for misty morning walks, surprise snow days, and anything a trip to the dog park might bring. The whole collection brings together water-repellent technology and classic style, so you can stay warm, dry, and comfy during your everyday adventures. Check off your errands with the Wool Runner Mizzle. Dash through cold and wet weather with the Wool Dasher Mizzle. Or upgrade to next-level protection with the Wool Runner Up Mizzle Plus. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. ALLBIRDS.com, code FRESHSOCKS.